welcome to Lakeshore Updates. I'm Dee Dodson. On this edition of the podcast, you hear the latest on the first confirmed coronavirus case in Indiana. The town of Griffith plans to exit Calumet Township, await the signature of Governor Eric Holcomb. A Gary firefighter used a city-owned computer to steal $4,000 from a woman's bank account. Jenny Lindsay reports on the State Board of Education releasing 2019 state school accountability grades. And Chris Nolte has a conversation with Franciscan Health spokesperson, VP for Medical Affairs, Dr. Eric McCavis. All of that and more on this edition of Lakeshore Update. Indiana health officials have confirmed the first illness in the state from the coronavirus outbreak. State Health Commissioner Dr. Chris Box said Friday the ill man was in stable condition in self-isolation after going to an Indianapolis hospital late Thursday with symptoms. Box said the man had traveled to Boston where he was exposed to others with the virus. The man had a cough and low-grade fever and did not need to remain hospitalized. Health officials are reviewing the man's travel and who else he had been in contact with since returning to Indianapolis on Wednesday.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dodson.
One signature is all that stands between the town of Griffith's official exit from Lake County's Calumet Township and its anticipated incorporation into North Township. The Indiana Senate voted 32-8 Thursday to accept the House version of Senate Enroll Act 365 and to send the legislation to Governor Eric Holcomb, who is expected to sign it into law. It passed the House Tuesday, 64-30. The Times report, if enacted by the Republican chief executive, Griffith will have until June 30th to continue attempting to voluntarily join either North or St. John Township, despite both previously rejecting Griffith's entreaties. Should no deal be reached, the legislation states Griffith automatically will become part of North Township. The town's transfer out of Calumet Township would become final January 1, 2022. Griffith residents voted by a margin of 98% to 2% to leave Calumet Township in 2018, in part because of the high property taxes they pay to the township, which also includes Gary, relative to the services received. State Senator Rick Niemeyer, the bill's sponsor, said putting Griffith into North Township finally would close the books on Griffith's 8-year process of exiting Calumet Township and eliminate any chance Griffith might have to permanently remain in Calumet Township. Opponents of the measure pointed to the negative impact Griffith's exit from Calumet Township will have on nearby taxing units, many of which already are in financial distress, due to the interaction of assessed value loss, local tax rates, and the state's property tax caps. North Township Trustee Frank J. Mervan is wary of being forced to accept Griffith since he doesn't fully know how it will affect current and future township services, such as Dial-A-Ride, or whether Calumet Township can reasonably sustain losing Griffith. Rick Rifa, Griffith's Republican Town Council president, said if Griffith becomes part of North Township, the town's residents will pay approximately $580,000 a year in property taxes to the township, compared to $2.2 million to Calumet Township, in return for up to $50,000 in annual township services used by Griffith residents.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dodson.
A man and woman faced charges after a Gary firefighter used a city-owned computer to steal $4,000 from a woman's bank account to pay bills. The Post-Tribune reports Demario Richardson and Antonine Stansel were charged February 29th with two felonies each. On September 23rd, after transporting someone to Methodist Hospital Northlake in Gary, Richardson logged into the Regional Federal Credit Union on one of three firefighter department computers to transfer $4,000 from a woman's account with the same institution. The woman told police that Stancil, her co-worker, had once helped her log into her credit union account. Court records show, when talking to officers about the claim over the phone, Richardson was vague, telling them, quote, someone had given him the woman's account information for the transfer. Online records show Richardson and Stancil bonded out February 29th, paying a $2,000 cash surety each. Richard's initial hearing is set for March 18th, while Stancil's hearing is scheduled for March 16th. Both are charged with fraud on a financial institution and theft between $750 and $50,000. Mike Gonzalez, a spokesman for the city of Gary, said Richardson was hired in September 2018. He was placed on leave Wednesday, the same day Gary learned of his charges. Gary Mayor Jerome Prince said in a statement, if convicted, Richardson would be fired.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Curtis Hill would be forced to step down as Attorney General if his license was suspended for at least a month under an amendment passed by the House Monday. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Lauren Chapman reports that follows a disciplinary hearing officer's recommendation last month of a 60-day suspension.
The amendment alters the qualifications and says if the office holder's license is suspended for 30 or more days, they forfeit their position with a replacement named by the governor. Current law only requires the attorney general to have a law license and live in Indiana. Republican Representative Tim Wesko says his amendment is a matter of good policy. Is it acceptable for the AG to hold a suspended law license?
I propose to you that aside from all present circumstances, the answer is no. It is not acceptable.
Attorney General Curtis Hill is accused of groping four women at a party in March 2018. Ultimately, Indiana Supreme Court justices will decide if Hill faces any punishment stemming from those allegations. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Lauren Chapman at the State House.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
A bill that would require schools to test for lead in drinking water passed the State House Thursday. The measure was originally aimed at Lake County schools, but as Indiana Public Broadcasting's Rebecca Thiel reports, it was recently amended to include all Indiana schools.
Kids who get exposed to lead can have trouble learning, behavioral issues, and poor kidney function. The bill would require all schools that haven't tested for lead at least once since 2016 to do so within the next 2 years. If the results are higher than the federal limit, schools would have to take action. Democratic Representative Carolyn Jackson authored the bill.
We do not want to be classified with Flint. We are better than that.
Right now, schools aren't required to participate in the statewide testing program through the Indiana Finance Authority. More than half of the schools that did participate in 2017 and 2018 had at least one fixture above the federal limit. The bill now moves on to the state Senate for consideration. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Rebecca Thiel.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
After months of delay, the State Board of Education released 2019 State School Accountability Grades Wednesday. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jenny Lindsay explains what they mean now that the governor has signed legislation to prevent schools from being penalized for last year's iLearn scores.
The so-called hold harmless measure means schools won't receive a lower letter grade on the state system than what they did in 2018. More than 100 schools received higher grades, but no schools will see any potentially lower grades until next year. That includes high schools where students didn't take iLearn. Meanwhile, the federal accountability system will still hand out ratings using iLearn results. More than half of Hoosier schools were either rated as meeting or exceeding expectations last year. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jeannie Lindsay.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Indiana lawmakers have rolled back a proposal that could cut how much insurance companies pay for medical services performed at offices located away from a hospital's main campus. That action came after hundreds of doctors and nurses descended Monday on the State House as Indiana hospital officials protested the payment limitations that had been added last week to a wide-ranging bill that Republican legislative leaders have touted as a step towards controlling ever-growing healthcare costs. Indiana Hospital Association President Brian Tabor says the billing proposal would have cost hundreds of millions of dollars in hospital cuts and lead to loss of medical services.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
5 years ago, Indiana experienced one of the nation's worst HIV outbreaks. Mike Pence was governor then, and he approved a needle exchange to keep the problem from spreading. Now, state leaders are debating whether that exchange and others can stay open. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Mitch Ligon has the story for Side Effects Public Media.
The 2015 outbreak came in Scott County, which sits between Indianapolis and Louisville. The rural county is one of Indiana's poorest, with fields of corn and soybeans surrounding small manufacturing hubs. At the outbreak's epicenter, the HIV infection rate was comparable to sub-Saharan Africa.
About 95% of the cases were also co-infected with hepatitis C. And so all those cases back then were linked to injection drug use, sharing syringes with each other.
That's Michelle Matern, now the county's health administrator. As the crisis deepened, health officials said needle exchanges would slow the disease's rapid transmission. Then Governor Mike Pence signed an executive order allowing the county exchange. At a news conference in Scott County, he explained his decision this way.
I will tell you that I do not support needle exchange as anti-drug policy, but this is a public health emergency. And I'm evaluating all of the issues and all of the tools that may be available to local health officials in light of a public health emergency.
Over time, other counties have approved exchanges, and now there are about a dozen in Indiana. Based on population alone, Matern expects about 25 new HIV cases each year. The most she's seen in the last few years is 12. But all Indiana exchanges are now in jeopardy. If lawmakers don't intervene, the programs will expire next year. State Senator Ron Grooms doesn't want to extend the expiration date. I caught up to him in the crowded Statehouse atrium, where he said the programs just aren't doing their job.
It was intended to be an exchange. It became a giveaway program in which hundreds of syringes were being given away at any given time, at any given location, at multiple locations.
Grooms represents part of Clark County, directly south of Scott. Clark County felt the effects of the HIV outbreak, too, as people came for treatment. Eric Yazel was an emergency room doctor at the time.
In 2015, if you came in and told me that, you know, I'm using heroin and I need some help, I'd hand you a paper that had a phone number on it for a place that had a couple-month wait, and that's literally all that we had to offer.
Now the county's health administrator, Yazel says overdose deaths have dropped by 50%. He shows me their needle exchange, tucked away in a corner of the health department. Shelves hold needles, alcohol swabs, and other supplies. The agency also provides counseling services.
You use things repeatedly, it lets bacteria out in your bloodstream, and you get infections of your spine and heart valves and things like that. So we have different needles here, and we have other products that, you know, typically would be used over and over again when someone's using IV drugs.
The North America Syringe Exchange Network provided needles and other supplies to 435 programs last year, including dozens in the Midwest. Executive Director Paul Lukoski says it's counterproductive to end these programs if the evidence shows they're working. Research from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention supports that view. It shows needle exchanges help reduce the spread of infectious diseases like HIV. They also can help people overcome substance abuse. Here's Matern, the Scott County health official, again.
People will still continue to use. Just because there aren't clean syringes available, they will go back to using and sharing dirty syringes. And so we're going to see disease spread again. It may not be the first year, it may not be the second year, but eventually we're going to see the increase of disease start again.
Meanwhile, state legislators continue to discuss needle exchange's expiration date. Matern and Yazel say educating the public and lawmakers about the usefulness of the exchanges is paramount to the program's success. For Side Effects Public Media, I'm Mitch Legan.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Here's Regionally Speaking host Chris Nolte with a conversation about coronavirus preparedness with Franciscan Health Vice President for Medical Affairs, Dr. Eric Makatis.
People are concerned all around the nation and around Indiana about the coronavirus as we watch and listen to the news to find out the latest about how the virus is spread not only around the world but around the United States. What is the coronavirus? Let's find out more about it, and in particular, how folks here in Northwest Indiana are preparing for it, because it's very possible it could land here, so to speak. We're going to talk now with Dr. Eric Makatis about the virus itself and how Franciscan Health is preparing for it. Dr. Makatis is an internal medicine specialist, but he is the Vice President for Medical Affairs at the Franciscan Health Crown Point facility. And thanks for joining us on the program today.
Thanks so much for having me, Chris.
Well, first, tell us more about the coronavirus, what we know about it right now, and I guess maybe the closest relative, if you could call it that, might be the flu. What are the differences? What are the similarities?
Sure. You know, I think just to kind of level set, coronavirus is something that's been around for a very long time. It typically, the normal strains that we're usually exposed to will cause kind of upper respiratory infection, cough, sniffles. We have had kind of new viruses that have come about that are also part of that same coronavirus family, and some of them are probably somewhat familiar. You've probably heard of SARS and MERS. Those have been in previous years. Those are also part of that same virus family. So as it's being called now, COVID-19, so coronavirus disease 19. 19 is from the year that it all started. And as I think most people are aware, the epicenter of that was in China. It's similar to influenza in the sense that it's a virus, and, you know, we're seeing typically, you know, we talk about mortality rates and all of that. Influenza is, 20 to 24,000 a year. Bad years, we may see up to about 60,000. So when you do the math, it ends up being about a 0.1%, 0.2% mortality rate with influenza. Coronavirus, this new virus, there's current numbers are significantly higher than that, but there's a lot of within the medical community, some kind of, discussion about, are we really just seeing the sickest of the sick right now? Given the testing capabilities worldwide, we're probably only screening those really sick patients. So the current thinking is that number is extremely overinflated. So they're estimating it's probably going to be very similar to influenza in the sense of how people are getting sick, how well they do afterwards, as they kind of go through the disease process. Kind of in general, we're expecting it to be somewhat similar to influenza. Now, with that said, it is a little bit, especially for the general public, a little bit scary in the sense that it's new, and there are some differences in the sense that right now testing is being ramped up. The government in general is trying to kind of get in front of it and ramp up the testing kits and the availability for it. Influenza is something we can do just at the hospital level right now because this new virus is so new. We're having to send out tests as of last week from Indiana to the CDC in Atlanta. And more recently now, the state of Indiana is able to, at the state lab in Indianapolis, perform testing. Because of the limited testing capability and because of the very specific reasons that we would test, state Department of Health actually helps healthcare facilities and clinicians kind of walk through the algorithm for who's recommended for testing before they'll actually approve sending down the test for screening. It is very specific. It's anybody with travel to or direct exposure to somebody who has contracted the disease or traveled to China, South Korea, Iran, Italy, Japan, kind of those high-risk areas, the areas where we're seeing kind of the bigger outbreaks. So that's kind of the general look at the disease. In terms of Franciscan, right now we're, very much focusing on you know, the main effort, I'd say probably 90% of what we're doing right now, is education and awareness for our frontline clinicians, hospitals, and our physician network clinics. We're also working with our emergency preparedness teams, both at the hospital level as well as the district level. We've been stocking through that work with the emergency preparedness teams. We're stocking additional personal protective equipment. So with this virus specifically, it's recommended that healthcare professionals use kind of the heavier duty or mask. It's called an N95 mask. So it's not just that regular face mask that you would wear for someone with, let's say, maybe pneumonia. Our supply chain at the corporate level is also working with our suppliers. We're making sure that we don't, you know, that we have kind of a plan B for any suppliers who might be sourcing the equipment out of China as this situation evolves. There is a chance that that supply may be a bit of a bottleneck, so we're looking at kind of secondary sources where we can get additional resources from. So that's already in place. We're kind of looking at plan B and C down the road so that we're ready. In terms of general public, Chris, I think that was another question you had asked about. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we're seeing a lot of, you know, if you look online, we're seeing a lot of runs on masks and availability. You know, this is some price increases, even if you look on Amazon for these masks. The general recommendation from CDC is that that isn't very helpful just for walking around in public to start, you know, wearing masks all the time. These masks really are only good for 20 to 30 minutes once they get, you know, moist. They don't really act as a great barrier anymore. And without proper training, removing them, there's a high risk of contaminating yourself, even if you are exposed. Really, the general recommendation is not to really wear them out in public or start trying to buy them up kind of just in case and keeping them at home. And then to protect yourself, it's really all the same stuff as influenza. You know, standard precautions, right? Hand washing, covering your cough and your sneeze, you know, not touching your eyes, your nose, your mouth when you're out and about. You know, anybody who's sick, kind of, and this is more in general, not just for coronavirus, anyone who's sick, if you're sneezing those droplets, it's about a 6-foot radius of, you know, those droplets traveling out. If it lands on surfaces, those surfaces can remain contaminated for several hours. So if you think about, you know, someone sneezing or, you know, then touching a doorknob, that's contaminated, and you touch that and then you touch your mouth or your nose, you've basically infected yourself. So, you know, being very mindful about not touching your face when you're out in public without first washing your hands. And I think most importantly, staying home if you're sick. We're recommending for all of our healthcare workers, if you've developed a fever, if you're having, you know, those upper respiratory symptoms, really you should be staying home, kind of self-quarantining until you're fever-free for at least 24 hours without using, you know, Tylenol, ibuprofen, fever-reducing medications. You want to be, you know, not coming back to the workplace until you're fever-free.
Dr. McIntosh, I know that this has been talked about before, and of course with the flu, it's always important to avoid contact with somebody who's sick and trying to deal with that. But I understand, too, that not only do you have the person-to-person contact of possible infection, but sometimes it's even just contact that it may not necessarily be person-to-person with surfaces. Is that the case with coronavirus?
Yes, it's very much just like influenza. It's the same idea. So if you have a contaminated surface, let's say, you know, someone with the flu or coronavirus sneezes and it all lands on a table and you've touched that and then you infect yourself, that's where you get that kind of community infection where it may not be, you may not even realize you were kind of indirectly in contact with someone who was sick. But you, because through touching kind of the same surfaces, being in that same enclosed environment, you've now contracted from somebody who you didn't even realize really was exposed.
I understand that, of course, this all originated in the Wuhan province of China, and I understand that a lot of the original cases of coronavirus came about from people that were dealing in open-air markets, and in particular, people who are handling animals that were in the market, and normally they would be handling them anyway. It's their regular diet in some cases, but somehow or another they got infected. Is that something that we have to watch in particular? Certainly is what you eat and how you eat it?
Well, so here it's, I think, less so of an issue. What we've seen with most of these, even SARS and MERS, and now with COVID-19, what we're seeing is that there's oftentimes a transition kind of animal or source where you get a mutation with the virus and then it starts to infect humans. So in this case, I've heard two possible sources. I think bats and snakes are kind of the two things that I've heard the most of. I think bats kind of leading the leading theory right now for where this came from, I should say.
Well, it sounds like it's something just to watch out, because it seems to be changing and developing as it goes along. And we're just doing the best we can, I guess, to deal with what's out there and to try to resolve it as best as we can.
Absolutely.
Well, Dr. Mikaitis, thank you for spending time with us to talk about the coronavirus and certainly how Franciscan Health facilities here in Lake County and around Northwest Indiana are dealing with the possibility that there will be cases of coronavirus that may show up over time. Thank you for your help in explaining things and keeping us apprised as to how the hospital system's working on it.
Well, thank you, Chris, and thanks for having me on the program.
We're talking with Dr. Eric Mikaitis, who is the Vice President for Medical Affairs at the Franciscan Health Crown Point facility, and he is an internal medicine specialist. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. It's time once again for Building Northwest Indiana, and here's Kevin Comerford.
Thank you for joining us today for another edition
Regionally
of
Speaking
Building
with host Chris
Indiana.
Nolte can be heard each Monday through Thursday at noon on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM, and streaming online at lakeshorepublicradio.org, where you can also find podcasts of the show when you click on the program link. For the latest in local news and information, tune in Monday at 6 a.m. for Morning Edition with local host Chris Nolte. Lakeshore Update is supported by the listeners and members of Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. Podcasts for Lakeshore Update are posted each Friday on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, as well as on NPR One. Make sure you search for WLPR and select us as your home station. Music for Lakeshore Update was written and produced by BenSound.com. For Lakeshore Update, I'm Dee Dotson.